Take me where the promise is.
My name is Alex, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Alex.
Welcome to the Monday 8 p.m. Speakers Meeting at the NAVA Club. We're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on aabluechipspeakers.org will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. And tonight's speaker is Sharon, coming to us from Clarkston. She's had a busy weekend preparing for an anniversary, and she's still here doing more service work, and I'm very excited to hear her story.
Thank you, Alex. And thank you for having me here tonight. It's always a pleasure to be able to be of love and service to any group, and I'm especially love NAVA. I haven't been here in a while. NAVA does good work, for sure. I am Sharon Freelant, and I am an alcoholic. Hey, everybody. And my sobriety date is September
7th,
1982. All right. So you know, I wasn't always ancient. When I came in, I was 33 years old when I picked up my last white chip, 33. So I was young when I came in, I mean, barely. And, you know, I'll try not to do too long of a drunk log and try to get sober, but I will qualify. I was born in Jacksonville, Florida, and my family, my dad was a practicing alcoholic, and he would tell you that, too, if he were here. He did go to AA for 90 days, and he went back out. He never could get back. So, growing up wasn't that bad, I have to say, because he hadn't really hit the skids too bad yet. And, you know, I had a couple brothers, and my grandmother lived with us, and, of course, my mom. And he was very good, had a good work ethic, and he was a good provider. And my mom worked, too, in a time period that women did not work outside of the home. She really wanted to do that and was able to do that. And my grandmother lived with us so she could take care of us, you know. And, you know, I was born in 1948, so believe me, women were not working outside of the home even for 15 or 20 years after that. So anyway, we had a lot of fun, you know. We'd go to the beach every weekend, and we didn't live too far from the beach, and we would, or we'd go to Kingsley Lake, and it was so much fun. And when I was with my dad, I felt so safe. I mean, he would take me out beyond the breakers and throw me up on his shoulders, and I have all these wonderful memories of him. And but then alcoholism stole him away from us, stole my father from me and from the rest of the family. And I knew he drank too much, but somehow I knew he couldn't help it. I don't know how I knew that. I knew he was sick and that it wasn't like he was a bad person. I knew he really couldn't control it. And the one thing I said, you know, of watching him all those years is, well, when I start drinking, I won't drink like him. You know, I won't need to do shooters in the morning to get to work and, you know, keep a half a pint under the seat and that sort of thing. I won't need to do any of that. And I've watched him, and I know what not to do. So when I start drinking, it was never a thought, I won't drink. It was always, when I get to start drinking, I was looking forward to it long before it was time to even have my first drink, which was when I was two. I'm told they came in the living room to find me with a slit tall boy turned up like this, and I drained it, and they put me to bed. And that was just going to be the first of many that were just like that. Drain it and put me to bed, if you could get me to bed. And you know, when I had my first drink, I went to Catholic school. My mom was a convert, and my dad never went to church. He was a Catholic, and he never went to church. Sometimes he would go, like on Easter or something, but he never went to communion. And I kind of took note of that, you know. And but my mom was like this devout Catholic, and she wasn't even really Catholic. And so she wanted to make sure we had a Catholic education, and I think that's why she worked, honestly, was to help provide for that education. And they did. All three of us went to Catholic school. And it was I'm grateful for that. I was taught by the Dominicans first and the Sisters of St. Joseph second, and the Dominicans were really good about instilling discipline and studying, and they didn't want you walking off the line too much. At the time, I didn't like it. It served me well later in life, though, and I appreciate that today. But when I was the middle of my junior year, when I had my first, what I called my first drink that I was aware of, I was 14. My best friend lived at the beach, and so she, you know, we were having spend the night parties a lot, of course, and she was having to spend the night party at her place, and there was probably six or seven of us gathered up, girls, and both her parents were alcoholics, so they had a pretty expensive liquor cabinet, and we had decided we were going to drink, and all of us were just like, this is going to be the first time any of us had really done the deal, and so they weren't going to miss it because they had so much. She says, I'll just get some vodka out, and then we'll need a cooler, we're going to need ice. Orange juice would be good with it. I've seen my parents drink it with orange juice and this and that. And we're going to go in the mangroves to drink. So this isn't like someplace that's easy to get to, lugging coolers and, you know, all this stuff. And we got to walk, too. None of us are driving, so we got to walk to the mangroves and then climb into the mangroves. And I said, wait a minute, this doesn't make any sense because we really only need one thing, and that's the bottle of vodka. If you insist on little paper cups, that's fine. You don't want to drink after each other. But we don't need ice and orange juice and coolers. We just need the vodka. And, you know, that's how an alcoholic thinks. You know, we're not going to a tea party. And we didn't tell the guys where we were going. We was all top secret, of course. Well, we didn't tell the guys where we were going, and it wasn't long before we were all blind drunk, and right out of the gate, blackout city. And my best friend, who probably could use a chair in here, she was in a blackout too. And so, you know, they tell you don't go in the water after dark. That's not too wise, and for a lot of reasons. Well, we did. You know, when I drank, caution to the wind. It didn't matter. I was bulletproof, and we need to swim at night. I'll, you know, keep my clothes on at least, but not make any promises about later, but right now. And we did, and we got into the ocean, and we were so drunk. And we started getting washed out. We couldn't even stand. We started getting pulled out, and thank God the boys figured out where we were. And all of a sudden, one of their cars was roaring up into the ocean. I just remember the doors flying open when we had floorboards. And they pulled us up on the floorboards and pulled us in. And I think we would have drowned that night had they not come and done that. So my first time drinking, I'm in a blackout. I nearly killed myself accidentally. I mean, I should have just said right then and there, you're going to be just like your dad, and you better just stay off this stuff. But that wasn't the case. And middle of my junior year, my dad, now by this time, Dad had really come downhill. And it started happening after the boys left home, and I was about 12, I think. And his alcohol, he was really going to bottom, and he was really sick physically. He had diabetes. He had kidney stones. And he got sick, and I remember him being in the hospital a long time, and when he came out, he wasn't drinking, and which was unbelievable. And that's when he went to AA, and he went for 90 days, but he couldn't stay stopped. And, you know, I suspect he probably didn't do everything that we were supposed to do, work the program and so forth. Of course, it was in 1961, and so still kind of early AA, I guess, but it's when you were a pariah and you were a bad person to society if you drank alcoholically. And so after that little brief period, when he did drink, it was so much worse, and he became violent. And he was in the shipbuilding business, and he had been in the shipyard business his whole life, and he was a vice president of the shipyard, Jacksonville Shipyards. And he drank himself out of the job, which is nearly impossible to do in the shipyard business. Nearly impossible. I mean, I remember his office and his boss's office had a huge bar. And when he would take me in on Saturdays and drop me off on the ship, and the sailors would take over and watch me, and I'd go to the kitchen and see these giant cookie trays. And anyway, they'd entertain me. Usually a carrier would be in dry dock, and they had stores and PXs and 3,000 people on that ship. In the meantime, my dad is back in the office supposedly doing work. By the time he came to pick me up, he was fried, and they were all fried. So they drank, you know, copious amounts of alcohol all the time, yet he got fired. So he must have really been standing out by this time, and took a geographical cure, the first. And he couldn't get a job in Jacksonville on the ship's only business because of his reputation by now. Next thing I know, we're moving to Albany, freaking Georgia. And the Southwest armpit, I hope nobody's in here from it's a great place to be from. And of course, I'm coming in all hip, slick, and cool from Jacksonville. I'm a surfer, and I'm driving a, you know, little Austin Healey Sprite, and you know, I'm waiting to see people in their bandanas with their pitchforks and all this sort of thing. And it wasn't quite like that, but it was a time warp. And the problem with it was I'd never had to make friends. They were already built in. I went to school with the same people my whole life, so I didn't have to make friends. And now all of a sudden, I don't know anybody. I don't know a soul, and I was scared to death. And the fear that overtook me, I remember being, and to add to it, they're sending me to public school because there are no Catholic schools, because they don't even like Catholics in Albany, Georgia. And so they had a Catholic church, they had a Catholic grade school, no Catholic high school. So I'm off to public high school. It was like being thrown in the deep end of the pool without a vest. And I was kind of excited about it because I figured the rules and regs would be loosened up a little bit. And but I was also terrified. I'm going to a public school with boys. We were split in Florida. The boys' school was on one side of the street, girls on the other. And they tried to keep us apart as much as possible. And so when I went to school the first day, I just remember being plastered against this wall, praying the bell would ring to let us in. And it, you know, I just didn't speak to anybody. I couldn't speak to anybody. I was just frozen with fear. I started experiencing that paralyzed by fear. And fear started, you know, taking over, driving the show. I started making decisions based on fear. And now I wasn't drinking at this time because I wanted to fit in. I was pretty much of a people pleaser, so I wanted them to like me. And it was a closed society, I'm here to tell you. The girls were not, I mean, you talk about mean girls, they would make the mean girls of today look like Rebecca of Sunnybrook Farm. They were very closed, not welcoming in the least, and that didn't help. So how am I going to, you know, so then how am I going to get in with them? How am I going to make, so I said, it's going to be a guy. That's how I'm going to get in with them. I'm going to go in the back door. And so I picked this guy that was hot and, you know, a big man on campus, vice president of the student body. He drove a sports car too, a little MGTD. And his parents were quite wealthy. We were not. He was on the right side of the tracks. I was on the wrong side. And members of the country club. And I thought, free ticket. Jump on this boy's coattail and ride. And that's what I did. And that, and it worked. He, all his friends became my friends. I was at all the parties now. I was accepted now. And I still wasn't drinking and smoking because in those days, good girls didn't do that. Now, they were all getting laid out in the Chevy every Friday night, so you weren't drinking or smoking. So I behaved myself and didn't do that either for a while. And so they did take me in. And then we stayed together. We got married is what we did later, but we stayed. I wasn't letting him go. Kidding me? This is the ticket. And I had my, you know, I'm taking him hostage, buddy. And he seemed to love me, but I did love him very much, which was a bonus. But I wasn't letting him out of my eyesight, that's for sure. So we were at Albany High. We graduated from Albany High. I had no idea what I was going to do after college. I had good grades. They told me I was fairly capable of intellectual work, although I felt pretty stupid, to tell you the truth. I had a hard time in public school. It was way harder than Catholic school. It was tough. I couldn't do the math. I mean, some of the subjects I did well in, and some I did not. So I got in trouble at the school once with the Latin teacher, and she was old and set in her ways, and we were going to integrate, and she was having a fit about it. And I, who am the left-wing liberal of all times, decided to say my piece to her in the class, because she's going off in the Latin class, believe me, there were just a few of us. So I said, well, Miss Dobbins, wouldn't you just get as much joy and pleasure from teaching black children that have never been exposed to Latin as you would us? Well, that's when I started getting F's. And she said, only a Catholic would say that. And I've never experienced any discrimination. That was the first time in my life I'd experienced discrimination as a Catholic. And it was rough. I mean, she rode my ass. I mean, I was making my grades drop. I couldn't do anything to get back in her good graces. So now I'm back on the outside looking in. Although I didn't care much. I thought, just, you know, at first, she's just an old biddy. I'll just fail Latin. I don't care. And then after we graduated, my best friend, I had a best friend in Albany, sweet, wonderful girl, and she said, I'm going to St. Joseph's Nursing School. What are you doing? And I had no idea. I mean, most people have applied, and they're in, right? And I'm graduating, and I don't know. And I said, well, St. Joseph sounds good to me, because I'm always tagging on to people, tagging along, you know. If it wasn't the guy I was riding his coattails, then I'm going to ride hers to St. Joseph's, and I did. And I got in, that was fun. And boy, that's when then I drank. So I got up to Atlanta and started drinking. Same thing. First night out at nursing school. Now, it was a Catholic nursing school, so that's kind of ironic. I'd come full circle. They had nuns posted at the desk. You were to be in by 7 p.m. during the weekdays and 11 p.m. on the weekend nights, and you better not be drinking and all this. And the first night there, I got so drunk. And we were downtown Atlanta, this is a million years ago, 1966, and went to this place called Ruby Red's Warehouse downtown. And I have no idea who took me home. I know it was a guy. And, you know, the miracle is that I'm standing up here alive. That's not the only time I did that. Just gotten a perfect stranger, no idea who he is, nothing. He took me back to the nursing school, and I'm in a blackout, and stumbled in the nursing school I did, and that was going to be a series of nights. And that young man that I was on his coattails was at Emory, nice and convenient. That was another reason I made a decision for St. Joseph's, because he was going to be in Atlanta too, couldn't let him too far out of my sight. And by that spring, I was alcohol is making all my decisions for me now. And I'm only, I was 17 when I went to school. So I'm only 18 years old now, and alcohol's already making my decisions for me. And I got scared of chemistry for no rational reason. There was nothing to say I was going to fail it, but on the chance I could fail, and they would all know that I really am stupid, I'll have to quit nursing school, even though I'd wanted to be a nurse my whole life. So I did. I even gave up the diet because I was so terrified. And my dad, of course, he's into his alcoholism pretty good. He was so wonderful. He came and picked me up. He gave me a good work ethic, too. He was actually a good dad in spite of the drink. But he came and picked me up by himself, not Mama, because she didn't come. He never said a word like, I can't believe you quit. Why did you quit? Nope. He didn't say a word. He said, well, baby, come on. Let's get your stuff in the car. We're going home. And so we did. And when we got home, he says, now, oh, I don't know what we talked about on the way home. But anyway, when we got home, he said, okay, I'm going to give you a week to just kind of rest and you know, get yourself your feet on the ground. And then you'll have a job the next week. And I don't care where, but you get a job. And right after you secure the job, I want you to start applying to colleges because you're going back to school. And I don't care where you go. So that's what I did. Thank God for that he had that ethic. I got the job. Now the boy's up at Emory, and he's not being alone like I thought he would be, so faithful. And he wasn't. And so I thought, well, heck, what's good for the goose? I'm starting today, too. And except I was starting to seek lower companions. I wanted wild guys all of a sudden, and the troubled ones. You know what I mean? So that's what I picked. Then when I went, I did get accepted to the University of Georgia, and I went to the University of Georgia, and oh my God, I had reached the promised land. No one is seeking out for drinking, believe me. We are all drinking the same, and it's like I'm even kind of a lightweight. And I damned if I didn't have 8 o'clock classes every quarter. I can't tell you how many I missed. So I'm wildly drinking now. I'm away from home. I'm in my element. This is great. And this guy that I've been telling you about, he transferred to the University of Georgia. So after being at Emory for a couple of years. So he's back, and we just picked up where we left off, and I've got my little claws right back out and clenched them in so I could keep him in the hostage position, and he did. And so, when we got out of school, this was in the 60s during Vietnam, we were going to go to Canada, actually. But we were, I know this will shock you, I was a war resister, and he was too. And we did march in the streets. Anybody wonders how I voted Tuesday. He said, I can't do it. Because he was going to law school, and then he decided he didn't want to go to law school. So Uncle Sam had a number 18 draft number. So Uncle Sam sent the letter to him immediately. He said, I can't do it. And I said, well, let's just go to Canada. And he said, let's do. And a lot of people were doing that in those days. And we talked to his parents, and his dad was great. He said, you've got to understand you can never come back once you do the MIA thing. So we thought about it, and we said, maybe that's not the best. He went in the Air Force, and I was teaching at this time. We graduated, and I was teaching in Augusta. Again, I'm wide open. My keeper is at boot camp, and I'm wide open. We're engaged now, and I'm worse than ever about going out with whomever. Couldn't be alone. It was the same story. I didn't know anybody in Augusta, and what would I do? Well, I would just capture another guy till just to have on the back burner until my fiance got home, and that's what I did. And I had a couple of them too. It was getting very crowded, and so then my fiance came home, unexpectedly got a medical discharge of all things. And we were shooting up flares, thank you God. And so he got home, we got married, and we stayed in Augusta. He taught in the Catholic school, back to the Catholic school, and I taught the deaf. And I was totally unqualified to teach the deaf. My degree was in Therapeutic recreation, don't laugh. Therapeutic recreation, which I was expert at, for the mentally challenged, which I was one of them, so that was good too. And they kept me, they didn't have a warm body for these poor deaf kids, and so they, I'm teaching deaf kids that can't hear a thing. And there's five of them, and I'm just having a ball. We had, I said, well, we're going to just improvise. I don't know sign language, nothing. So we're making gardens out in the backyard. All the other teachers are looking like, oh, my God, you know, I drove a motorcycle to school. Orange Yamaha. That got some attention. And they would just look at me, the other teachers, but she's on the motorcycle today. And then I'd bring my little VW bug and take the kids on field trips without parental permission. Just take them off the campus. I mean, they'd arrest me today. Put five kids in my Volkswagen bug, no seatbelts, you know. Just hang on, kids. Off to the nursery we'd go to buy more plants. Come back, plant vegetables. It was so much fun. And nobody said a word. They didn't have anybody else to teach them, so they just, I think they might have learned something. And I had a great time. I thought, I never thought of being a teacher, but it's kind of fun. And he taught too, and then he's an entertainer to this day, actually. He and his band just celebrated 50 years in Atlanta. And so when he got ready to go on the road, it was about this time, I was always very supportive of anything he wanted to do. I said, let's do it. Sounds good to me. So let's go. We're going to start in San Francisco over at Haight-Ashbury. I said, yeah, good. And then somebody said, I don't know if it was a parent or what, said, well, maybe you shouldn't go 3,500 miles from home on your first excursion. Maybe you should stay a little closer to home just in case you don't make it. And so we went, okay, that sounds good. Thank God we didn't go to Haight-Ashbury. I'd be dead as heck. That thing was wide open, and everybody was just, you know, what you got there? Okay, I'll have some. Looks like a good color to me. You know, so I did that. And I wasn't, I was alcoholic. But anything in the storm. And so we stayed there, and he became very successful. And I became the hole in the donut. I packed the bags. Now I'm really on his coattails. I'm not working. But it's kind of cool because we're getting free liquor everywhere we go. That was part of the deal. And we started getting jobs in Colorado, and they did really well. And I am so grateful for his job because it really rocketed me on the downward spiral. All that free booze and keys to the liquor cabinet. We ended up buying a bar, TJ's, it's out in Sandy Springs. Went in partnership, and then we had our own nightclub. Oh my God, are you kidding me? We got our own nightclub and keys to the liquor cabinet. And so we drink round the clock. And again, and we worked in Underground Atlanta when it was the first Underground Atlanta and it was the real Underground Atlanta. I served cocktails at Muhlenbrink's and he worked at PJ Kenny's. And again, it was just like Georgia. Nobody's standing out there. Everybody's getting drunk every night. And so, you know, then time passes, and we've been on the road for 8 or 9 years, no kids. I wanted children very much, but, and I'm drinking all the while. The drinking's getting, I'm doing worse and worse. He's, you know, getting weary of it, and weary and weary. And so then we just, you know, we've been trying to have a child for a long time, and I did get pregnant. I was 30 when I got pregnant, and I thought, this will be it. I'll have this baby, and we're going to have a nice home and a baby, and I'll be such a great mother, and I won't even need to drink anymore, because all my dreams will be fulfilled. And I stayed sober as soon as I found out I was pregnant, I did not drink. And I had done that a couple times, stayed sober for 30 days or whatever. It wasn't even that hard, I think. I don't know why, but it wasn't. I'm grateful for it. I was scared of fetal alcohol syndrome. It was really in the news a lot, and I thought, I don't want to have this, put that on my baby. So, and I wanted to be a sober mom, and I did it. And without AA, without just white knuckling it, but I was always wanting a drink. I always was thinking about a drink. I wish I could have a drink. They were all drinking. I was like, oh, that looks good. That cold beer on a hot day looks really good, but there's the baby. And so I had the baby and stayed sober for about 2 or 3 months. I was nursing, so I didn't drink until one day. And that day was always coming behind these staying sober on my own deals. It was always waiting around the corner. In the back of my mind was, when you get to drink again. And I had, it really fooled me, staying sober by myself. It was a double-edged sword because I didn't know alcoholism was progressive and fatal. And I didn't know that my alcoholism was continuing on that time I was dry. And so when I picked up my first drink after that period of time, I'd never had so much trouble in my life. I had 2 sangrias and I was blind drunk. I couldn't drive. I was drinking people under the table before the baby. Now I can't have 2 drinks and I'm wiped out, driving drunk. It was horrible. And I couldn't take care of my child. My husband was getting ready to, he's waiting. When this happened at the country club with the ladies at noon, and I'm crawling to my car, and they're begging me not to get it. They never seen me like this. They're begging me not to drive. I drive. I can't make it home. I pull into my husband's partner's house. He has to come get me. He has to go to work at like 7 or 8. I have nothing to feed her because I'm nursing. Friends had to come over and bring whatever you call it, formula and stuff. And this was the thing that was going to be my saving grace, this baby. But as soon as I drank, what baby? What baby? And so alcohol once again became a power greater than myself, and it was what I loved more than anything. I would say I loved my family the most, and I did love them very much, but I had to have a drink. And if that meant, well, I just stopped nursing, that's all there is to it. We'll get a lot of that formula in now. That won't be happening again. And it went bad from there. It was progressive and fatal. And I ended up in the hospital. I was getting physically ill. Now, remember, I'm only 32, 33 years old. I've been to AA twice before. I went once when I was 21. And I was just to get out of the doghouse with my husband. And Poor Boy Rice was speaking, who's this old-timer, but he's gone a long time now. But he would wear bib overalls at the podium. So I walk in to Glen Haven Stone Mountain, and he's at the podium, just like I am, with bib overalls and very few teeth, and talking about having done vehicular homicide by killing his mother while driving drunk. And I'm sitting in there, just my little best outfit on that I could muster up that night, thinking, oh my God, that's not me. And I'm really glad these people have a place to come because I am alcoholic, but they are seriously alcoholic. They need to be off the streets, no question about it. Thank God they've got this AA thing to go to. Check you later, I'm going to bail. So, I improved my story and, went down a little more. And the second time I went, I was in Colorado when it happened, and it was Steamboat Springs, and I was 29 at that time, the year before I got pregnant. And I became violent, just like my father. And I attacked my husband and broke his glasses. And, of course, he's like, trying to just sort of, wasn't very powerful, so it was kind of pathetic. But I can tell he was not happy. This was like another level for me. So I called the central office again, and the lady came out in a whiteout, did all the wrong things by herself in the middle of the night in a whiteout, picked me up, took me to her house, and I don't know what was going on. I can't tell you really much. I can't remember too much of what happened, except I think I did a 4-step with her that night. But something about her, she acted like I was going to stay sober the rest of my life. She gave me her best stuff. She said, we think you should go to 90 and 90 and, probably stay out of the nightclub while you're here. You can hang out with us. I said, no. I started my yes buts right away. I said, I can't do that because, my husband is the entertainment and I'm his wife. I have to be there every night to support him. Now, mind you, he's begging me not to come. Please don't come. So I'm giving her all the reasons why I can't do any of the suggestions she's giving me. And she didn't blink an eye. She just, okay, well, we find it works better if you do, no problem. And she took me to a couple meetings, and I never forgot her. Her home wasn't ostentatiously grand, but it was very nice, and it was a home. And she had a fireplace going, and she was very calm and gentle. And then this is the middle of the night, so when they're Catholic, by the way, so the family starts getting up to get ready for Mass, and the husband and the little children come down, and they look all this, so nice. And I'm looking, and the home just reeked of love and peace. It was attractive. Attraction, not promotion. It was attractive. I never forgot that night. I didn't stay sober, but I never forgot that night. She was an enormous seed planter in my life. And so after I started drinking again, it took me 2.5 years to get hit bottom. And my daughter was a big part of why I quit drinking. I didn't quit drinking for her. I had stopped doing that, but she was definitely a catalyst. And I had become physically ill. I had alcoholic hepatitis. The doctors said, you're going to not make your 40th birthday if you don't stop drinking. The next step is cirrhosis. And my aunt died of cirrhosis at 29 years of age. So I knew I could die at 33 of cirrhosis. And he said, I guarantee you, you won't see your 40th birthday. And you have a child, and she'll be an orphan. And so then one time I asked them before they gave me that spiel, when I was first in the hospital, they started telling me my liver test results, and I said, it was this associate that was in there, and I said, he says, your liver enzymes are really terrible. I said, what would make them do that? And he said, he looked at me dead in the eye, and he says, well, I don't know, unless you're a lush. And he turned on his heels and walked out. He knew I was lying. He knew I was a drunk. It was so great. Another seed planter. My doctor was another seed planter. And so I stayed sober 30 days so that my liver test would get normal again. But I really wanted to drink. I almost did, and my husband said, don't do it, Sharon. You don't do it. You can't do it. You know, your liver's bad. And I didn't. And then 30 days, the liver's kind of magnificent. It returned to normal, and it was all good, which was a great relief because now I can drink again. And so I did have another spell of drinking that was in August. So I went on for another month or 6 weeks, and I started jeopardizing other people's lives. We were big sailors, and we were down in the Caribbean, and I took a bunch of people out on the dinghy, and all the sailboats, it was windy, and so all the sailboats had their stern and their bow lines out, and I was really drunk. And so I don't know why they would follow me and do what I asked them to. I mean, hey, come on. There'd be a group that would always follow me and say, okay, we'll do it. And so we'd go flying through the harbor, wide open as fast as I could make that dinghy go. It's a miracle I didn't decapitate someone. A miracle. And it would have decapitated them if we hit one of those lines. And I thought, you know, I don't care much about myself, but I couldn't live with myself if I killed someone else. It was when I started endangering others' lives because of my drinking that it started getting my attention. And the last night I drank, my daughter needed me. I had a perfect routine going. He went to the club. He left the club at about 6 in the evening, and he didn't come home till 3 or 4. My daughter was on the routine of bedtime at 7. Once I got her tucked in, read stories, you know, we tucked in, we talked, we chatted, we did all that in her little precious nursery room. And as soon as I got her all tucked in, I went down, and now I can drink. I got hours to drink like I want to. And so I had a gallon jug of some terrible wine. I did like fine wine, but I was just drinking whatever. And I would drink it. It was like a Chablis, and then because it was really easy to drink most of it up, put the water in it, put just enough yellow food coloring down to it that I had to find science, that it would look like Chablis again, and it would look like nobody had a drink. And he didn't drink wine. He drank scotch. So I knew I was safe. So I could just go wild and drink while he was at work, and she never woke up. Well, that night she woke up, And that night, I had drunk with reckless abandon, and I can't tell you why. It was a Tuesday night. It was almost like somehow I knew this was the last night I was going to be able to drink. I don't know how, but I drank everything I could get my hands on. Homemade Kahlua, anything that had alcohol in it, I'm drinking. And so, of course, I'm in a blackout. And when my husband came home that night, he found me passed out on the sofa with my daughter on the floor, asleep next to me, with the fireplace on and the doors wide open to the fireplace. And we had a swimming pool just steps from the back door. And I had the swimming pool doors wide open. And she was 2 and a half. And he was beside himself. And it was like the days of Wine Roses, if you've ever seen it, where they fight over the children. That's how it was. And I was pulling her, and he was pulling her. I'll never know to this day what she needed, but she needed something. And, you know, by the grace of God, she didn't go out to that pool and drown or get in the fireplace or what all the things that could have happened. But that was running through my husband's head, too. And you know when the handwriting's on the wall, that they really mean it this time. They're, you know, he's kicking me to the curb. I have used up all the get-out-of-jail-free cards, and I just knew. You could tell, you know, you could tell that he's not going anywhere. I'm going somewhere. I'm going to have to go away, bad dream, and I'm not supporting myself. He's the one with the bucks. I have nothing. I'm still, you know, I became more of the hole in the donut. So that definitely caught me. I felt it, but something changed in me, too, and so that night, what was left of it, I went to sleep, and when I woke up and kind of got my wits about me, I just remember going, God, help me. I had never said that before. Never. And all I know is I've never had a drink since I said those words. I didn't know much about AA. Treatment wasn't rampant like it is now. I knew about AA. I knew it worked. I didn't know how or anything it was about. I knew people that had gone and not drank again, so I knew that. And, you know, I'd had my little 2 drive-by visits, and so I saw that. And I called the central office for the 3rd and what I hope will be the final time. And Helen answered the phone, and Helen said, well, would you like to go to a meeting tonight? And I said, oh, yes, definitely. And she said, would you like someone to pick you up? I said, oh, no, I can get myself there. Don't need any help. I don't need that much help. You know, I didn't want to be dependent on anybody. I don't need anybody coming by my house, for God's sake. And I said, I'll get myself there. She said, there's this woman's meeting at 8 o'clock in Clarkston. It was a Wednesday night. And I said, I'll get myself there. I can barely get to 8 o'clock. I was so, for a lot of reasons, I was actually excited about going. I felt like something changed when I said, God help me that night. Something shifted down from my head to my gut because I had known I was alcoholic for a long time. What I couldn't accept was that I was powerless over alcohol. And that night, I became powerless over alcohol. And so when I went to the ladies' meeting, they are hysterical. I'm thinking, well, if they'd have had this crop in here when Poor Boy Rice was speaking, I'd have probably stayed because this has changed. Boy, this is a great group of women. And what had changed with me, I had better eyes to see. I was listening with better ears, and I was relating to them instead of trying to not relate to them, which is what I had done before. I didn't have any DUIs. And this lady said, yeah, well, how many do you deserve? Well, I drove drunk all the time. I deserved a lot. It's a miracle I didn't have any. So they told their story that they 12-stepped me, like an old-fashioned 12-step meeting. It was fantastic. And all of a sudden, I had come in that meeting as this hopeless, bad kid. Hopeless. If they can't help me here, I'm sunk. And so all of a sudden, they're telling their stories and they're funny, and they're laughing at all these stories, and I'm just relating like crazy. One lady lost the turkey at Thanksgiving, found it the next day in the dryer, said, well, it looked like an album, it had lives, and we were laughing and scared, you know, and I'm thinking, this is great. And so they didn't, they got so busy, they got so busy socializing after the meeting, they forgot to go to the newcomer and give me a big book and a meeting list and put their numbers in the book. They were too busy with their friends chit-chatting. So I always remind people our job is to stay sober and help the other alcoholic to achieve sobriety. Look for that newcomer that's picked up the white chip and ask them if they need a book or help or would like your number. Then you can go socialize. So I came back the next week. They said, oh, my God, you're back. I said, well, it's Wednesday. I've been waiting, and that week was a long, long week. I thought, well, you just go. They have it on Wednesday at 8. I'm back at Wednesday at 8. They said, nobody told you 90 and 90? Nope. What's that? Nobody gave you a big book? Nope. Okay. So they brought me in, and they gave me all the things that they gave me their phone numbers, which I thought was really sweet, but I had no intention of calling any of them. I wasn't particularly fond of women, although they were kind of fun. And I thought, what would I have to talk to them about anyway, you know? And but there was this one woman I really liked. Her name was Carol C., and something about her. And today I know that it's my higher power has this ability to match us up perfectly with the right person at the right time with the right information. And she needed me, and I needed her, and she was perfect for me. She sponsored with what I call a velvet glove. She would say things to me, like when I told her I wasn't doing step 2 and 3 because I didn't tell her why. I just said, it's none of your business what I think about a higher power or God or whatever you want to call it. I'm not doing 2 and 3. And she said, well, okay. I said, I'm going to skip them, and I'm going to go to 4 and 5. And she said, well, we find they work better if you do them in order, but I'm not your higher power. So let's do 4 and 5. So write it. This is like in December. She said, write it. And I'll hear your 5th step on January 2nd. And thank God those were the days that nobody fired a sponsee. Where that came from, I don't know. That insinuates that you're their employer. Well, I have an employer that's much greater than anybody, my sponsors or anybody else. I have a new employer, and it is a higher power. And I don't tell anybody what to do. I tell them what I did. You want to do it? Great. You don't want to do it? Okay. You know, that's fine too. Maybe you have a better way, just like she did with me, you know. So I did it that way, and then I went back and did it in order. And we discovered in my 4th and 5th step what I was afraid of with 2 and 3. And that was the deal. And so then we started doing it in order. And after I was 18 months sober, my first husband and I divorced. And the truth of the matter is, while there were some extenuating circumstances, I drank my marriage up. I know that today. I just drank it up. And he stayed with me, I think, until he knew I was going to be okay. Till he thought, like, she really is going to stay sober, I think. I remember him giving me my first white chip, and he cried from the podium. And he's not a crying man. He's a very manly man. And he cried from the podium and thanked everyone for doing for me, that helping me. And so I think once he got comfortable with, she's okay, I think these people are going to help her and she's okay, he wanted to leave. And you know, he tried to come back one time. It was so funny. One time he wanted to try to come back. But we just went on different paths. Nobody was wrong. We just went on different paths. And I just set him free. And it was the best thing for both of us. I'm not sure I'd be sober today if I was still in that fast lifestyle, honestly. So you know, I was in the middle of the AA bed from the get. I made coffee. I'm not on my own. They would say, make the coffee. Okay. Empty the trash. You got it. I mean, whatever they suggested, I did. Sometimes I might argue with you about it, but I did it. And I stayed at meetings, 90 and 90. From the get, and I said, now what am I going to do after this 90 and 90 deal is over? She said, 90 and 90. I said, really? And she said, yeah. And I said, well, okay, well, when the second 90 and 90 is over, what do I do? She said, 90 and 90, then you'll have a blue chip. I said, okay, I can do that. She says, what I did, so I want you to do what I did. I thank God for her being in the meeting every day for the first year. Oh, my gosh. I learned so much. I learned how to become a sober woman. I mean, not just put the drink down. When they said the drinking's just a symptom, you've got to learn to live sober. You've got to find out about the causes and conditions. You're going to mature and grow up. You're about 14 coming in. You know, we've got to get you to match your age. And so I just listened to them and laughed it up. I thought that was a little harsh. I didn't really feel like I was acting 14, but okay. And they were right, I was. And so, you know, that really was an amazing rocketed into divorce dimension. And so when we did divorce, I did feel like I was going off a cliff. I really did. Because I mean, you know, my coattails, he's out of my clinches. What will I do? How will I support myself? I can't take care of myself. That was still there, even though I was sober. I don't know how to do this. And about what a 14-year-old would say. And so, you know, I went and started the neighbor. And then this is where God's like showing off and showing up. And the neighbor said, you know what? I had a medical background. The doctor down the road needs a vision therapist, and I don't know anything about vision therapy, but I didn't know anything about teaching the deaf, so I said, what the hell? So I went down and interviewed, and I said, what am I going to tell my sponsor? I said, what am I going to say? Where am I going to say I've been for the last 12 years when they want to know, you know, your job history and all those things? And I went in, and she said, well, we're going to pray first. We're going to do the third step prayer. We're going to pray that, and then we're just going to let the chips fall where they may. If nothing else, this will be a practice for interviewing for a job. So I said, okay. So we did that, and I get there, and I want you to know they didn't ask for a resume, and they didn't ask where I've been for 12 years. Are you kidding me? Who does that? And so they asked me back for a shadowing day to shadow the other therapist, and I did, and I thought, this is pretty cool. I like it. I think I could get into this. And I love the people I was going to be working with. So they said, okay, we're going to pay you minimum wage. At that time, it was $5 an hour. We're going to start you at $5 an hour. And my face is like, oh, isn't that generous? And my inside's going, are you kidding me? I have a degree from the University of Georgia by hook and by crook. I have this Bachelor of Science, and I've been this, and I taught the deaf after all. And, you know, you're going to pay me minimum wage? And so I took that story to my sponsor, and she listened intently, you know, let me go on for 10 or 15 minutes. And she said, well, sounds to me like you got a $5 an hour raise. And I thought, wow, that was that velvet glove coming out. You know, I didn't think that way, you know. And so I did start there at $5 an hour. And I'm still there after 30 years. I'll be celebrating 34 years in January at this job. I'm 76 years old. I'm still there because I love it. I'm still working because I love it. And I'm the lead vision therapist, and I'm the practice manager. And I don't make $5 an hour. And I have a wonderful boss. He bought the practice from my previous doctor, and he is wonderful. He is beyond wonderful. It's just like a dreamboat to work for. And, you know, that, again, is my higher power using me, you know, to be of love and service. And my specialty is the traumatic brain injury and stroke and autism. And I have a gift for that that God gave me, and I love it. And we have helped so many people come back from the dark side and feel like they were hopeless for another reason. And so we're just like this great team, and I love to go to work. You know, it's really hard for me to retire. I'm being encouraged to do so, so I'm thinking about it. I do have some health issues. That liver that was acting up earlier on, I started having trouble with it about 10 years ago with the enzymes being crazy. And they finally did a biopsy, and about 4 years ago, I was diagnosed with a fatal liver disease that hardly ever see. It's called congenital hepatic fibrosis. It's very rare. And they said, wow, we haven't seen what, this is the head of the transplant department at Emory. So if you were younger, I'd do a liver transplant, but you're too old. I don't think you survived the transplant. I said, well, okay, well, what do we do? He said, well, there's no cure, and we don't know what causes it. So we're just going to have to watch it. We know what's going on. It's not too bad right now. He said, I said, well, what should I expect? He said, well, we don't know. We've never seen anybody this old with it. Usually you die in utero. You might live to be 18 months. Or if you do survive that, you could be maybe 40, and that's about it. And you don't have children. I have a child. I wondered why I never had any more, because I did want more. I have a child, and it's like they want to study me at Emory, bodily and physically different from our fellow man. So now they want to study me. But what came to me was, you know, I could have gotten all worked up about the thing, and it did take my breath away for a minute. And I said, well, what should I, you know, what should I be planning on? He says, well, honestly, I think you're going to outrun it. He says, it's not getting any worse. It's moving kind of slow. It's unpredictable. We've never seen anybody your age with it. I think you might outrun it. And I said, well, okay, I'll go with that. But what I thought about was the odds of me surviving, I would have definitely died drunk had I not stopped drinking. And he told me that. He said, oh, my God, if you hadn't stopped drinking, you'd been, you wouldn't have made 40. And so I started thinking about why did I survive this thing, and why do I have this really weird disease that should have killed me and may eventually, but I'm pretty okay. And that's when I thought, I think God really does have a purpose for me. So instead of getting all depressed about it, I started thinking about my purpose here, you know, that I have been given this gift of life against all odds for a reason. And I've done my very best in sobriety to be of love and service and sponsored and done that, and I'm still doing it. I still chair meetings. I still sponsor. I love AA. It's the most comfortable bed I've ever been in the middle of. It is the easier, softer way. The only time that it's not easy is when I resist it. The resistance is what makes it difficult. When I don't want to do it, I just don't feel like praying. This morning I'm a little sleepy. I need to have coffee. And that's alcoholism talking to me. Yeah, stay in bed with me. In fact, skip the whole week of prayer and meditation. So I'm always on guard. I know I have a one-day-at-a-time reprieve, and it's based on the maintenance of my spiritual condition that I continue to be sober. So I'm not going to stop doing what has worked so well for 42 years. I'm not about to stop doing it now. Plus, it's so much fun, just like it was that Wednesday night at 8. It's so much fun to be with you guys, and we just laugh at the craziest things, but you get me. I can say the craziest things that you're laughing at that, you know, regular people would be, that's horrible, what are they talking about? You get me. And we just have the best time. They told me my life, if they could give me a crystal ball at 5 years, what my life would be like, that it would be unimaginable. And I thought, I think they're just at the hook. They're trying to keep me here. They were right, and then some. If I'd have made myself a wish list when I got sober, I'd have sold myself so short. I have this sober husband that I've been married to 37 years. He just chaired our 49th anniversary. He's funny. He's charming. He's maddening. He's like the mad scientist. He has a big case of ADHD. But his pluses far outweigh his minuses, and we've had this wonderful relationship. We go share recovery together, but I'm not his sponsor, and he's not mine. We don't even go to a lot of the same meetings. We keep our programs separate. And I'm glad I was married when I came in, because I do see the wisdom of that, not getting involved with somebody else the first year. Not sure I could have pulled it off if I hadn't been married, but I do see the wisdom of it, and I see why it gets people in trouble, because then that other person becomes your higher power. And I don't need a meeting. I need to go to dinner with, you know, John and whatever. And we're going to the lake, and, you know, I'll get to the meeting later. So I see the wisdom of that today. And I have a daughter, and that daughter is 44. She's sober a little over a year in Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you, God. I took her to meetings the whole time when she was little, because, you know, I got divorced and all. And I drove her to meetings, and Carson let us do that. A lot of us were divorced about the same time, came in together about the same age, kids the same age. And so we drove them to meetings. They had a business meeting one time about it. And they weren't sure they were going to let them stay because they were a little rowdy. Mine wasn't. But some of those children were not well behaved. And so they were going to ban us. But then they didn't. They said, no, no, the group conscience prevailed. And it needed to, because some of us, including myself, couldn't have come to that meeting if we had not been able to bring our babies. And I was conscious of it. I had become less selfish and self-centered. So when she came, she cleaned the windows. She loved it. She thought it was a great, you know, I'd give her little chores to do. She cleaned the windows while we were having a meeting. So she grew up the whole time in AA. And when it came time for her to need Alcoholics Anonymous, she knew what it was about, and it was here for her, just in the same condition it was here for me, and so she has a little over a year. I have a 16-year-old grandson who just started driving who is an angel in skin, and I'm not kidding. He calls his Uma, and out of the blue, he'll call me and say, and he's like a regular kid, you know, playing basketball, likes the girls, all that, and he says, he'll call me and say, Uma, yes, he says, just thinking about you. I want to tell you I love you and miss you. He's 16. He's still doing it. He comes with me every summer. Still wants to come. Came last summer at 15. I couldn't believe it. We did dye his hair blonde because he was really into that at the moment. He didn't have blonde hair. And I nearly was taken to court by his mother. Uma, what do you think about this blonde color we can do this summer? And I said, show it to me. And he did. I said, well, okay. I think it would look great. And boy, did I get in trouble for that. So I've had to learn about, you know, I'm not that perfect at boundaries. That's her child, not mine. I had to make amends, you know, that why didn't you call me and ask me if it was okay with me? And I'm thinking to myself, because I know you said no, and I thought it was going to look adorable. You know, still want what I want. So I don't have a halo yet. But I am living the happiest life that I never imagined. That what they said was true, and I wanted to drink my whole first year, I'm here to tell you. It was a good thing I was going to meetings every day. But it's been the most incredible life. I have to pinch myself. Sometimes I say, just because I don't drink one more day, all things are possible. And when tough times come, you just don't drink no matter what. No matter what. I don't drink. And I don't do it alone. You know, and some tough stuff has happened. And I call my sponsor and I get with my girls. I call it a fellowship. I don't like network. I think fellowship sounds a little cozier. So I call the fellowship. I call on my fellas to support me. And they do. And it passes. And I learn from it. There is always a lesson or a blessing, sometimes both. And so no matter what, I don't drink. I'm way over, so I'm going to stop. But thank you so much for that.
Thank you, Sharon. Thank God for funny women in AA. All right, I've asked Misty to do the tips.
Hi, my name is Missy and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
We have a chip system to denote your quantity of time in your sobriety. Your quality is between you and your higher power. Tonight I want to offer the white chip. Anybody new or coming?
First I slip and then I crept to a hope-filled dream. You rescued me and finally waking there I see Walk eternally.